Our reading this morning is from Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9, reading through to chapter 5, verses 1 to 12. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in this place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping of the wind. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know what they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in the province, do not marvel at the matter. For high officials watches over high official, and higher officials over them all. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is saved from the field. He who loves silver would not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eats them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Amen.
So Ecclesiastes is certainly a difficult book to get to grips with. It becomes a bit easier, I think, if we realise that the writer is asking us to join him on a journey as he thinks through the things that are happening in the world around us. And such is the breadth of his thought and the abrupt changes that he seems to make that some scholars have suggested it's many different authors. But it seems more reasonable to suppose that we have actually one mind grappling with many different things, and a mind that had a great deal of access to things, as certainly King Solomon would have done. And he's grappling with the world when God appears to be hiding himself from him, I think. And we've probably all come across times in our own lives when we just don't know what's going on. We may have encountered people who seem to have lost their faith because of something tragic that has happened to them. I recently read a book on called about the tsunami of 2004, and saying when the doors break, and talking about how suddenly so many people have been affected by that situation, and how so many journalists had taken this as an example of the fact that God, if he existed at all, couldn't possibly be good. And it is something that requires a little bit of getting to grips with, certainly. And if it happens in personal circumstances, it can become much harder. But what I think Ecclesiastes does offer us is some practical advice of how we should be thinking and how we should be living our lives. Now, the first part of the book leading up to the passage that we read this morning looks at the world and what it has to offer on many different levels. It talks about exploring wisdom, about exploring pleasure. There's a brief insight in chapter 3, verse 11, where we read, "He has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds. Yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end." And who of us can actually say that we completely understand what God is doing in all the situations in the world? We can point to a plan of salvation that God has worked out, but we can't really understand why some of the things that have been allowed to happen have been allowed to happen. We cannot understand exactly how God works in his world, although hopefully we will all have examples where we believe he really was working in the world and in our own lives. But the writer is putting themselves in the position of a humanist or a secularist for a while. Not an atheist, because an atheist simply wasn't really an option. People weren't atheists in those times. And he comes time and again to the one conclusion that everything is hebel, vanity, uselessness, a chasing after the wind. He seems to find no point in life. However, right at the end of the book, if it's not to spoil the story, he concludes that we should fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. And if we look carefully at the book as a whole, there's three times when he seems to take a bit of a pause from this searching out. And this is one of those examples. And what we've got here is some reflection, some maxims, some sayings, some proverbs, if you like, some home truths from which I think and hope that we can all learn. And the passage breaks into five parts in a way. We have in chapter 4, verses 9 to 12, the idea of companionship, verses 13 to 16, a commentary on popular acclaim, chapter 5, verses 1 to 7, advice on our relationship to God, what we say to God, what we shouldn't say to God. In verses 8 to 9, advice on how to view authorities, especially when they perhaps don't make a particularly good job of things. And finally, in verses 10 to 12, a brief commentary on money and riches. So let's look first at the idea of companionship. The ideas in those verses, I think, are relatively straightforward. They're not certainly only about marriage, but marriage could be included in the idea of two people helping one another. There's all sorts of other ways in which we have two people working together. We have partnerships. We have partnerships which are more than two people in business. Many other ways in which we can help each other. Each person in a partnership may bring different talents to the table. One person may be good at dealing with people, another person good at dealing with the technical details. There'll be savings in terms of shared premises and equipment in business terms. And the idea there is that the whole is greater than the part. That slightly offends me from the point of view of mathematical purity, but it's definitely clear that that is what happens when two people come together and complement each other. When one person is ill, the other person can care for them. Two can generally cope with to get together much better with opposition of any kind, whether it's physical attack or something else, because they can encourage each other when they're down. And as I said, it's not limited to two people working together. It's also hopefully evident in church fellowship as well. And the idea, I think, from the very beginning of time that God gave us is that we are not meant to live in splendid isolation. Yes, some of us will be more party people, if you like, than others. Some of us are introvert, some are sort of extrovert, but none of us should be living just on our own and for ourselves. But you might ask, if the benefits are so clear, why is the writer actually bothering to set them out in this fashion? Nothing comes without a price, does it? Two people don't work together without having to make some kind of compromise. If it's talking about marriage and people living together, they have to accommodate each other's habits. They have to do things differently from the way that they would have done them sometimes. And that is clearly difficult, as witness the high rates of divorce, the breaking up of business partnerships, political alliances, pop groups. They all seem to come to an end at some point. It all seems to be a bit transient. Yet despite that, the benefits are overwhelming. And he wants us to understand that in no uncertain terms, that working together is better than working alone. And then verses 13 to 16 refer to the idea of popular acclaim and how short-lived its nature can be. How easily people can come to be popular is evident from TV reality shows, if nothing else. They pervade the airways, but ask somebody 3 months later and most people will not remember a single name of anyone who was in them. Politicians are perhaps the nearest analogy to kings. Thankfully, they don't have the same sort of power, but they often have a honeymoon period when they first come into office, don't they? But when they fail to fulfill all the hopes, when they suddenly find themselves overwhelmed with the difficulties of satisfying people with very different views on things, their popularity can fail. I think that's happened with our current Prime Minister, but it's certainly happened with previous Prime Ministers as well. And in the Bible, King David went through the same sort of experience. But sometimes there's a danger that people in those positions reach the point where they will no longer take advice. And that's evident sometimes in politicians where the key thing that they seem to say is, we need to get our message across more to people. Where the problem in most cases is not that they haven't got their message across, but it's not a message that people want to hear and respond to. And for us, I think there are two points to come out of these verses. First is that popularity, whatever its form, is almost always likely to fade. For whatever reason, right or wrong, we should be prepared for that. And secondly, we should take note that very often the reason for that might be that we are no longer listening, no longer willing to take advice, or perhaps taking offence at being given advice. And then at the beginning of chapter 5, it moves on from our relationship with one another to our relationship with God. And the writer homes in on the way in which we worship and presses like the prophets for reality and sincerity. The approach is a quiet one. He's not addressing hypocrites here. He's addressing fools. In modern terms, he might mean someone who cheerfully turns up to church, enjoys singing, but only inclines half an ear to the words of the hymns or the scripture that's read. The person who never really gets around to fulfilling their potential, fulfilling the commitments for perhaps which they have volunteered for. And such a casual approach to God is sin. It's described as evil in verse 1 and as sin in verse 6. It's a warning that's not restricted to the Old Testament either. Matthew chapter 7, verse 21 reads, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only one who does the will of my Father in heaven." And to just look briefly at a couple of points in a little more detail. In verse 1, the idea of listening has the double meaning, not just of hearing it with your ears, but of actually going away and obeying it. And in verses 3 and 7, you've got a couple of proverbs there which link a multitude of words with dreams. And given the context, I think that means that we must pay attention to the phrases that we use. We must be thinking about what we are saying and what we are doing. Worship is a serious business. We might be better off being silent than repeating words that we don't mean and that we won't honour. There's an interesting reference in there about having to tell God's priest that you didn't mean it. What tended to happen in those days is that two people might come together and one makes a promise to the other and they had effectively a witness or a third party involved, which was the priest. And that's why they're saying, don't make some promise that you can't fulfill, some commitment that you're not willing to fulfill, because otherwise you're going to have to go along and say, I didn't mean it. Then in verses 8 to 9, we're given advice on how to view authority. It's another reflection on how to cope with real life, is it not? The idea is straightforward. We shouldn't be surprised at the existence of injustice, and there's some reasons given for that, the bureaucracy, the fact that officials protect each other. All things considered, authority is certainly an advantage for society, but it often goes wrong. The things that people actually want done are not done. The things that they do want done, the things they don't want done are done. Our very methods of electing authorities, as we do it these days, are also flawed. Some years ago, at a home group that I attended, we saw a DVD that talked about the time before Robert Peel. Remember, he was the first person who effectively instituted the police force. And one of the comments at that time was that everyone was in great danger of being robbed. Now, crime obviously does exist today, and in some respects it's certainly alarming, but I don't think that many of us would feel that we are in great danger of being robbed when we walk down the street. It's not impossible, but we don't go around worrying about it in most cases. Now, the writer is clearly opposed to oppression and injustice, simply doesn't want us to be amazed that it's there. But on balance, some kind of authority is for our benefit. Otherwise, things would be much worse for us. What should we respond? How should we respond? Well, we should seek to be involved in that, to try and change things for the better. But we shouldn't be leading revolutions and trying to overturn governments. But the deeper implication there is that it's only God who will ultimately be able to change things. Only God can cause permanent change. And in the meantime, life goes on as best it can. We shouldn't ever expect there to be some kind of utopian vision fulfilled on earth. I don't know how many people still have that hope. It seems to go up and down depending on what happens. But we should never have that hope. Our hope is in when Jesus comes again and when God restores creation, restores relationships, changes us as well. And then our final section is about the vexed topic of money. I don't know whether that's any more apposite at this time or not. But it's a compelling interest, as Jesus implied, when he warned us against allowing money to be our master or second God rather than our servant. And we've got three brief sayings which expose money for what it does. It creates a craving for more in verse 12. Attracts hangers-on, verse 13, and it deprives us of sleep, verse 14. And the craving that money creates for more is obvious, for example, in the gambler, and we might have in view also city traders with a view for their possible bonus, but also for the tycoon, or simply the well-paid, materialistic type of person, always with an eye on the latest new gadget, invention, or expensive toy. And those things don't bring satisfaction. In fact, I think sometimes they often take us away from things which are much better for us. I recently had a holiday in Switzerland, and I was talking about it before the service. And in fact, it was actually after having walked through the village of Muren that Siri and I were discussing. And there's a train that runs from this beautiful village down the back. And you can see from that train the Eiger, the Monch, and the Jungfrau, and the snow on the mountains. And my wife and I were just amazed that there were children with their parents there. They were just looking at their electronic gadgets when there's all this beauty around. So whilst these things have their uses, they also take us away from the natural world around us. And there's always the lure of a bigger bonus, a new gadget. There's always people who want our support, political parties, charities, individuals in need, relatives, those who simply want to find an easy way to make money for themselves. And some of those things might be right to respond to give to charity, maybe even to support a political party. But true friends will be hard to come by. if you have money. I'm finding the more we have, often the more we worry about things. The price of shares, the price of property, the interest rate on our accounts, particularly perhaps at the moment. And as the writer eloquently puts it, the surfeit of the rich will not let them sleep. On the other hand, the hard-working person who works for a living will sleep well whether they have much or little. In many ways in our modern society, we do live a life of ease, which means, for example, we get too little exercise, we eat too much, we possibly drink too much. I find it increasingly absurd that what we have is people spending money on exercise machines, on health clubs, and on detox diets, all to undo the things that they have used their money for. For us, the message is quite simple. Don't love money. Be satisfied with what we have. Use what we have wisely, acknowledging that it all ultimately comes from God, that we cannot take any of it with us. And so in conclusion, from this interlude, as it were, in Ecclesiastes, we should remember the benefits of being in partnership with one another, supporting one another. We should beware the generally temporary nature of popularity and always remain open to the advice of others. We should be serious and sincere in our worship. We should recognize the value of authority and organized government, but not expect too much of it, not be surprised when it doesn't seem to fulfill its purpose completely. And we should ensure that money is our servant, never our master. And finally, perhaps, we should bear in mind the conclusion of the writer at the end of Ecclesiastes. Fear God. And that's not fear in the sense of being afraid. It's a reverential sort of thing, a responsive thing, a recognition of who he is. Fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil.